Professor Philip Finkelstein, I know that at the Cole University denied me tenure, or didn't give it to you, but with events like this, speeches like this, and the books that you write, you earn tenure many times by the people that have some critical thinking left up here. With all the spins and the lies that the mainstream media propagates, words like yours and Ali's are like pure oxygen. And third, I want Ali and Professor Finkelstein to tell us whether they get invitations by Israeli universities to give speeches like this, and how easy it is for them to travel in Israel, how welcoming the Israeli government is of your views. Thanks.
Thank you for your kind comments. I've not been invited to any Israeli universities. I don't know if I'd go if I were. I certainly don't think that mine or Norman's views are very welcome.
There is no dearth of Israelis who are aware of the facts as anyone here is, and there are some very excellent people there. Most of the names are familiar to most of you. Gideon Levy, Amir Ahas, the people who work with the human rights organizations like B'Tselem, which is one among several. But the honest facts are, I think, we have to be honest about these things. Those sectors are getting more and more marginalized, and the spectrum is moving at a fairly rapid clip to the right. There was an interesting article today I just read before I came here by Gideon Levy, and he said that now all Israelis are agreeing that what happened in Gaza was a failure, which sounded good, if belatedly. But then he said, the reason they're all agreeing it was a failure is because Israel didn't kill enough Gazans, that they didn't go far enough in the massacre. And that gives, I think, a fairly vivid sense of how radically to the right Israeli society is moving. And also, which I think is as significant, how detached Israeli society is becoming from reality. There are many Israelis, including Israelis in prominent positions, who apparently do believe that in the Gaza massacre, they demonstrated their military prowess, and they demonstrated their capacity to defeat our armies. And if you recall in my remarks, I quoted one Israeli analyst as saying, folks, this was not a war. It was not a battle. He was talking to his fellow Israeli intelligentsia and the generals, telling them, folks, you are losing touch with reality. You did not win a war in Gaza. You didn't even fight a battle in Gaza. The society is becoming slightly, and I don't mean this facetiously, it's becoming unhinged. And that's a serious problem for Israelis, and it's also a serious problem for all of us, because it's a slightly unhinged society which has in its possession a significant number of nuclear weapons and a formidable army, and that we all have to begin to worry, where is this little country headed, and where is it willy-nilly taking all the rest of us? That's a serious issue.
Yeah, I'll keep this quick. I want to thank the speakers. This was an amazing presentation. Thank you to all the people that helped put this on tonight. I'm a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, and one thing that I would say is that you can't be against an occupation in one context and not be against occupation in another. You cannot oppose the war in Iraq and the occupation of Iraq and not also oppose the occupation of Palestine, and I would add Afghanistan. We need to see the connections, I would argue, between all three. I think that the resistance by Palestinians and the people of Gaza has been an amazing inspiration to all people who stand against imperialism. I also hope people will get involved in the BDS movement here locally on this campus. They meet at 5:30 on Wednesdays and with the Students for Justice in Palestine. Get involved.
Yeah, so we'll go to the right again.
You mentioned before about how the United States funds a lot of the weapons that are used, and I know that you are probably already aware of this, but there are massive profits to be made from conflict, and I just wanted to get your take on, I mean, peace is not prosperous. So I realize that there is a lot of anti-Palestinian sentiment in the Israeli state, but at the same time, any kind of conflict, whether it's Iraq, Afghanistan, anywhere, creates problems. I mean, how do we get past that?
Well, as you said, well, first of all, it's useful, and I would encourage everyone. This is a serious university, a smart undergraduate and graduate population. Hopefully that means that you folks still read. I know that's become a kind of a relic from the past. A decade ago, people used to come up to me and say, Professor Finkelstein, I read your books. I'm not sure if I believe that, but I like the sentiment at any rate. And then more recent years, say 5 years ago, they say, Professor Finkelstein, I read your interviews. A little bit of a regression, but still I saw the word read. And nowadays they come up and say, Professor Finkelstein, I saw all your YouTubes. I realize we're at a cultural threshold here, going in the wrong direction, I'm afraid. But anyway, I would encourage all of you to read the Amnesty International report. It's only 38 pages, but it's quite illuminating. The white phosphorus shells, which Israel indiscriminately used, as Amnesty said, in densely populated civilian neighborhoods. According to Amnesty, those were American-made white phosphorus shells. The tank ammunition, American made. And they went through the companies, they went to the ammunition use. It was a very ugly picture of U.S. culpability in what happened. On a broader issue, of course, it's true there are arms manufacturers who make lots of money. And it's also true, another ugly fact, but it's a true fact, and many truths are bitter pills to swallow, that many of the conflicts that Israel engages in, it uses them to test weapons, and then it then can market the success rate of its new weaponry as it tries to sell its weapons around the world. Now, some people may recoil at an analogy I am inclined to make, and you're of course entitled to recoil, but then you would have to tell me why the analogy is wrong. If we all agree that one of the more hideous aspects of the Nazi Holocaust was performing experiments on human beings, medical experiments which resulted in serious injury and often death, why isn't it equally hideous when a state flatly says that it uses a battlefield conflict as an arena for testing the efficacy of weapons, which it then wants to market around the world? Isn't that by any moral reckoning an equally hideous experiment with human beings? But that's in fact what happens. Of course, it's not limited to Israel, but it's also true to say that there's a certain amount to be gained by constantly engaging in these alleged wars where you can constantly test the latest weaponry and then go to arms fairs, as there are arms fairs, and then display the results, not in experimental conditions, but actual battlefield conditions of your latest technology.
Since before, but especially since World War II, the United States has become, in effect, a global empire. We, of course, don't call it that. What we call it is leadership, American leadership, although I don't recall anyone electing the United States to be the world leader. It was more foisted on them. But we've always been told that this American leadership, which now involves something like almost 900 foreign military bases, is necessary to maintain our prosperity and our way of life and to defend freedom and all of those good things. And yet it turns out that despite all of this American leadership, this country is totally insolvent. It's literally insolvent. It's insolvent at every level. The government is insolvent. It has to borrow almost $2 trillion from overseas just to stay afloat this year. The banks are insolvent. They're so insolvent that we can't even admit it. The reason they can't nationalize the banks or bail them out is because then we'd have to put a number on how insolvent they are. So war and empire has been incredibly bad for business. We are all going to suffer, maybe not all, a small minority of people won't, but most people in this country are going to suffer a real cut in their standard of living. For the first time, we will see, we've been told that, you know, every generation since the 1930s has done better than its parents. We will start to see the first generation on a mass scale doing worse and living worse than its parents. For those of you in college who are going to be facing the job market soon, you are going to be facing a grim situation. All of this is a consequence of the dogma of American so-called leadership, of foreign expansion, of investing all our resources in weaponry, hundreds of billions of dollars a year in weaponry and foreign military bases, instead of investing in people. And I don't like this xenophobic talk which comes from President Obama and others about foreign oil and investing at home. If we'd invested, we should invest at home, but we could have invested globally as well. If we'd taken a fraction of the trillions, the estimated $3 trillion that Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winning economist, estimates the Iraq war will end up costing, and invested that not just in this country, but around the world, in real solutions for people, what a different planet we would have, a much more prosperous planet. Now, you know, who says that that's not possible? Who says that's not possible? At this moment, when all the dogma that has been rammed down our throats for decades is visibly failing, now's the time to step up and start offering alternatives. We're not condemned to live in the world that we've created.
Israel is the largest recipient, or one of the largest recipients of military aid from the United States, which enables things like the Gaza massacre. I ask this question to both of you, and you'll need to suspend disbelief for a moment. What do you think would happen if our representatives in Congress and the Obama administration said to Israel, you must negotiate peace based on the Arab League proposal, and for every year you do not, we will reduce our military aid by 10%. What do you think would happen?
The answer to that, it seems to me, is very obvious. The U.S. doesn't have to do anything. All it has to do is threaten, and the show would be over. That's fairly obvious. Remember, Israel stops the massacre in Gaza on January 17th, January 18th. Why? Because it's 2 days before the American coronation of King Obama. We don't want to ruin, Israel doesn't want to offend, you know, les majestés, offending the king. So it has to suspend the massacre so the festivities can go on. And that's how Israel always carries on. Sometimes there's this silliness. Like there was last week this talk that when the Americans met with the Israelis, that the Israelis, quote, laid down their red lines about Iran. Israel doesn't have red lines with the United States. When the U.S. says goes, if we don't give the green light, there's no attack on Iran. In 2008, you may recall, Israel was busily trying to conscript the United States for an attack on Iran. And it recruited some unofficial emissaries, like the sometime historian and full-time propagandist, Benny Morris, who went around saying that if the United States doesn't use conventional weapons to attack Iran, then Israel on its own would use unconventional weapons, and many innocent Iranians would die. It was a very dire threat by the sometime historian, full-time propagandist, Mr. Morris. There was no attack by Israel on Iran. When it comes to vital U.S. interests, what the U.S. says goes. So if the U.S. merely threatened Israel, it's time, folks, to pack up your bags and leave. You have overstayed your visit. The hosts are a little bit tired of your presence. You've wrecked a few too many of their homes, killed a few too many of their relatives. That's not how guests should behave in other people's homes. It's really time to pack up and leave. And if you don't pack up and leave, you're not going to butter your bread anymore. And it would be over, it would be over in about 5 minutes.
Preemptive strikes, so I was hoping you could please explain the others around.
No, that's a good question. And we should, we should always be open to those sorts of questions. Because you never know if the person is asking the question because he or she is, so to speak, a plant, or the person just doesn't know. And we should not write anyone off. We have a big opportunity now. I totally agree with Ali. People are now interested. They are genuinely confused. And they are genuinely horrified by some of the things Israel is doing. And so we should all make an effort now not to be holier than thou, not to pretend we know all the answers, and to be open to hearing people out. I will accept the question on good faith and try to answer in adequate, reasonable fashion. Number one, I wasn't quoting the Israeli Foreign Minister Shlomo Ben Ami, that was another context. I was quoting Ze'ev Ma'oz, who is the director of the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies at Tel Aviv University, probably the most prestigious think tank in Israel. He's now a professor at the University of California in Davis. And I was citing from his book, Israel Defending the Holy Land, as I said, a very large volume. And as I also tried to emphasize, it was mostly a synthesis of the current scholarship on the topic. Now, the question is, and it's perfectly legitimate, he's saying everything I've come to understand is that Israel has constantly engaged in what Israel likes to call wars of no choice. Ein Brera, wars of no choice. And along comes this historian, and we're reasonably perplexed. He says it's not true. He says with the possible exception of 1948, none of Israel's wars were wars of no choice. He says the historical record simply flies in the face of all that we've learned or were told about the conflict. So now I'll invite the young man, if you don't mind, to just return to the microphone and point to one particular war, and I'll do my best to give an adequate answer as to what the record shows.
Sure. How about the war
1967? The June 1967 war. That's usually the example that's taken. Abe aimed at Israel's former foreign minister. He was the foreign minister and also the UN representative. He was known for his great command of the English language. The Arabs at the UN called him a wordologist because of his loquaciousness and mastery of English. And he famously said, describing that war in his memoir, he called the chapter, "To Live or to Die." That's what Israel faced in 1967, a war of no choice, or so he said. So what does the record show? Israel claimed two things in 1967. Number one, it said that the Egyptian president had imposed this strangulating blockade on the Straits of Tehran, through which vessels went to the Israeli port city of Eilat. And again, Mr. Amen, in his dramatic language, he said, Israel has been forced to breathe with a single lung. And secondly, there was the claim that the Egyptians and then the Jordanians and Syrians had moved troops to Israel's border and was prepared and on the verge of striking Israel militarily and defeating it. That's the claim. What's the record? The record is Israel barely used the Straits of Tehran 5% of its trade went through the Straits of Tehran. A lot of its oil went through the Straits of Tehran. That's accurate. But Israel at the time had 4 months' reserves of oil. So the blockade didn't pose any real problems in theory. And what's more interesting, in fact, Mr. Nasser, like many an Arab leader, was a blowhard. And 2 or 3 days after he declared a blockade on the Straits of Tehran, he started to let foreign vessels through. There was no blockade of the Straits of Tehran. So some of you are thinking, okay, but what about those troops who are poised to attack and destroy Israel? Well, as I mentioned earlier, Israel couldn't do then, and can't do now, anything without a U.S. green light, or at least a yellow light. So in May 1967, Israel sends over its generals, its diplomats, its intelligence people, and says to President Lyndon Johnson, the president at the time, they say, we're about to be attacked, we're going to be destroyed, we have to strike first. So Johnson says, okay, give us your intelligence information, let's analyze it. Israel gives the United States all their intelligence information. The United States then sends it to all of its intelligence agencies, of which there were about a half dozen. And all half dozen intelligence agencies come back with the same two conclusions. Number one, they say, according to our findings based on your intelligence information, Nasser is not going to attack. That's our conclusion. Number two, even if by some remote possibility he does, says President Johnson to the Israelis, he says, according to all our intelligence, you, meaning the Israelis, will whip the hell out of them. Those are his exact words. So, some of you are thinking, that's the American opinion. What was the Israeli opinion? Well, we know exactly what the Israeli opinion was, because on June 1st, the head of the Israeli Mossad, Israel's main foreign intelligence agency, he comes to Washington, D.C. And he says to the Americans, we agree with all of your military analysis and all of your military conclusions. We agree, he says. That means the Israelis agree. The Arabs aren't going to attack, and if on some remote possibility they do, we'll whip the hell out of them. So you might ask, why then did Israel attack? If it wasn't threatened, why did it attack? That was basically the same thing as what happened recently in Gaza and in Lebanon. There was this guy named Nasser, much to most of you will never have remembered him. He was this radical Arab nationalist, that's what they called him. Radical Arab nationalist basically means the same thing as nowadays Islamic fundamentalist. It's the same thing. It means Arabs who have this weird idea that they should have the right to control their own destiny. It's a weird idea. And what's even weirder, they have this idea that they have the right to control our, meaning American natural resources, which by some quirk of fate happen to be located under Arab soil. So this is also a real problem. At the time, the American special assistant to the president, Walt Rostow, he writes a memo on June 4th. He says, this massive fellow has to be cut down to size. That's the problem. And the Israelis say, these Arabs, they're getting, you know, sort of restless. They're getting out of line. They're acting uppity. And they act uppity. It was a divisional commander back then named Ariel Sharon. And he said that we are losing our main weapon. And what's our main weapon? He says, the fear of us. That's the problem. The Arabs don't fear us. This master is inciting them, and he's making all of these radical gestures. And we have to restore our deterrence capacity. Deterrence capacity means restore the Arab fear of Israel. And that's exactly what they did. They cut this ugly Arab nationalist down to size. And it's true what Ali said, for those years, it basically worked. At that time, hard to believe for this generation, but at that time, Egypt was the leading power in the Arab world. Everyone turned to Egypt for leadership. Now it's a kind of third-rate power led by a character they call in Egypt a laughing cow. And that's basically the result of what happened in the June 1967 war. As Ze'ev Ma'oz puts it, he says, yeah, Nasser said some stupid things, got himself in trouble. He said he got himself very high up on a tree, and he didn't know how to climb down. But he had no intention of attacking. And if there were any doubt about it, any doubt, you could have an excellent witness. At that time, Israel formed a national unity government and included the head of the right wing of the Israeli political establishment, a fellow named Menachem Begin. And Begin becomes prime minister in 1977. And during the June 1982 war, Mr. Begin gives a speech at the National War College in Israel. And in his speech, Mr. Begin, who was sitting on the Israeli cabinet in 67, he says, we must be honest with ourselves. There is no evidence that Nasser intended to attack in 1967. There's just no evidence of it. He said, yes, it's true, Nasser moved troops to the Sinai, but there's no evidence he was going to attack. And he said, word for word, we have to be honest. The June 1967 war was a war of choice. That's what the Prime Minister of Israel said in July 1982 at the Israel War College.
Questions for both Dr. Noam Finstein and Ms. Ali Adnan. After the tragedy in Gaza, people were out protesting in hundreds of thousands globally. But their protests weren't just aimed at Israel, the United States, or the European Union, but Arab states as well. And I know both of you differ on what exactly the solution might be for the Palestinian problem. So, in your own interpretation of what the solution is for both of you, what role do you see the Arab states playing in the solution of the Palestinian problem, if any?
Well, that's a great question. I think it needs to be broken down a little bit because I think it's an opportunity to look at the regional situation because over the past 8 years, of the Bush administration. Now, this wasn't entirely new. I mean, I think it's often too easy to blame President Bush for everything as if he invented a lot of these policies. There was a lot more continuity in Bush administration policies than people are willing to admit, as there is a lot more continuity now with Obama from the Bush administration than many people are willing to admit. But nevertheless, after September 11th, we saw a sharpening of these policies. And basically, the challenge the United States has set itself since World War II is to maintain control, to maintain its hegemony of the Middle East region. After World War II, the traditional or the former colonial powers, Britain and France, were in decline, and the United States came in replace them to fill their role. Now, there are people, believe it or not, as Norman said, who believe that the Arab world and the Arab countries should be left to the people who live in them to govern and to decide their destiny. That crazy idea is what is labeled, as Norman said, extremism or Islamic fundamentalism. The United States basically divided the region into two groups. Those states and governments that are supported by American power and benefit from American power. In every Arab country, there is an elite that has managed to align itself with, or almost every Arab country, with the United States and is supported by and benefits from American power. And across the region, there are also movements and some states that oppose American power, that believe in local sovereignty, that believe that people should be able to run their countries the way they see fit. Now, those who support American power have been labeled by the United States as moderates. Now, moderate is a loaded word. Moderate is good. Moderate means not prone to extremism. Moderate means reasonable. Moderate means people we can do business with. But what's behind this label, when you look, there's really nothing necessarily moderate about moderates. Saudi Arabia, a theocratic state by any standard, that is just has an atrocious record in every way, is labeled moderate. Egypt, which is run by a dictator, is labeled moderate. A dictator who is, I mean, the whole world is demonizing Robert Mugabe. Now, I'm not here to defend Robert Mugabe, but Robert Mugabe was willing to cut a deal with the opposition. Mubarak is absolutely unwilling to even talk to the opposition. I mean, Mubarak is by any standard as bad or worse than Robert Mugabe. And I think that Mugabe has more popular support in Zimbabwe than Mubarak does in Egypt. Nevertheless, this is what the United States labels a moderate, as well as other countries like Jordan, an absolute monarchy, and so on. These are the moderates. They are neither Democrats, nor are they necessarily secular, in the case of Saudi Arabia. On the other hand, on the other side, we have the so-called extremists. Those are people who believe in local sovereignty, and they include Islamists. Certainly, Hamas, Hezbollah are Islamist movements. They include secular regimes, like Syria, which is certainly not a democratic state, but it is secular. And the Islamists are often the only movements or forces in the region that actually have democratic mandates. Nobody can deny, whether you love them or hate them, that Hamas won a democratic mandate, that Hezbollah has a democratic mandate, that Iran has a system that is, if not what I would describe as a textbook democracy, a more complex and contested political system than we are usually willing to admit. With elections who, even if you know they have the candidates are screened by religious scholars or whatever, here our candidates are screened by people with checkbooks. It's all a different form of pre-screening. They have a different system of pre-screening. But nevertheless, the outcomes of elections are contested and so on. So it's a more complex picture than moderates versus extremists. The real split, and then there's another layer, and I'm giving this context because I think it's important. In recent years, you have heard pro-Israel, lifelong pro-Israel advocates, people like Dennis Ross, who is now a senior advisor to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, go around telling this story that, oh, the major split in the Middle East today or the Arab world is not between the Arabs and Israel, or between the Palestinians and Israel. It's between Sunni and Shia Muslims. This is the new narrative that they're trying to push. A sectarian narrative which is manufactured and which is used to incite Arab public opinion against Iran, because Iran now represents the anchor of the local sovereignty movement and resistance. And we saw this playing out with Hezbollah after 2006, after Hezbollah won, or at least fought Israel into a tie, however you want to put it, but it's the most generous interpretation one could put on it. It was universally hailed across the region as an Arab nationalist Islamist resistance movement. Now that would not do for the United States. So they tried to paint it as Shia, sectarian, and Iranian to turn popular opinion against it. It didn't work. It didn't work. But there was a concerted effort to incite a sectarian war among Muslims. And I even think that the execution of Saddam Hussein with the sectarian overtones was actually, if not intentionally designed, played into that, attempted to play into that. The point I'm making is that no matter how you demonize people as Islamic fundamentalists or whatever it is, the basic split in the region is between those who support local sovereignty, and the logical consequence of that is supporting resistance against foreign attempts to control the region, and those, on the other hand, who support and benefit from American hegemony in the region. That is the split. Now, the problem is the tide, despite all the efforts of the United States, if you ask the people in any country, their support is with local sovereignty. They want to see their countries run by and for local people. And that's why you saw demonstrations of a million people in the streets of Rabat in Morocco, in Turkey. You saw these massive demonstrations all over the region. And it's why we see the United States making increasingly desperate attempts to prop up its puppet regimes. You had an election in Palestine, which Hamas won in 2006. People don't forget these things quickly. You know, in Iran, people still remember when in 1953, when the United States overthrew the democratically elected government. People are not going to forget quickly how the United States worked with Israel to overthrow the first democratically elected government in the Arab world in 2006. This will not be forgotten. This will have deep consequences. But we still see Hillary Clinton. She went and did this show in Sharm el-Sheikh last week, where they gathered 72 countries, supposedly for a conference for reconstruction of Gaza. 72 countries, Slovenia and Slovakia, I don't know who were there. The only people who were not at that conference were the democratically elected representatives of the Palestinians. And Hillary said before that conference, and she said it again today, that this aid will only flow to a Palestinian government that basically meets the conditions laid down by the United States and is headed by the person chosen by the United States. Hillary, here's a message for you. It's not humanitarian aid if you put political conditions on it like that. It's not humanitarian. There's another name for it. Blackmail. It's nice to be American blackmail. And billions of dollars of American blackmail didn't work before, and it's not going to work now. Now, this, to come back to the question, what is the role of the Arab states? Well, I think you have to judge it based on understanding that regional context, that Gaza, the Palestinian resistance, and the Lebanese resistance represent not only a threat to Israel, not only a threat to Israel's ambitions in the region, but also a threat to these regimes which are increasingly illegitimate and increasingly set against their people. Because what people see across the region is a state system that has failed. States that failed to defend their territory, failed to defend their sovereignty, failed to provide prosperity for their people, failed to uphold and defend the dignity of their people or the independence of their people. And instead, people created their own movements, whether you love them or hate them. I'm not an Islamist. I prefer to see religion and politics separated, but I recognize that people created, instead of these states, that the states failed them, they created movements that defended the territory, that provided people with social services, that provided them with dignity, that were not corrupt, that stood for independence, and they gained support for that. They earned support for that. And if people see Hamas become corrupt, venal, follow the path of Fatah, cut unfair and corrupt deals with Israel or the United States, their support will go away too. The support is not because it's Hamas. It's because Hamas and other movements stood for what people wanted. They wanted dignity. They wanted independence. They wanted someone to stand up for their rights and defend them. And they earned that support. And this is a powerful example across the region. It's a powerful example in states which are run by US and Western funded and trained and supported intelligence services across the region. And so I think the potential for liberation in Palestine could unleash. It's the opposite of what Bush wanted. He thought they would, they would have elections and then, it would produce these pro-American client regimes. And it's the opposite. To maintain the pro-American client regimes, you have to suppress democracy in every form. You have to suppress free expression in every form. And it's an unsustainable system. The whole system is breaking apart at the seams. And what can be unleashed? People have a lot of fear. They say, there could be chaos. There could be disaster. There could be anarchy. Well, that's possible. But it's also possible that if people are given a chance, that they will create something better for themselves. And they make mistakes along the way. At least it's their mistakes. Just get out of the way and let them get on with it. In Palestine, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Syria, all over the region, there's enormous human potential. 50% of the population in most of these countries is under the age of 21. And there is enormous impatience in these countries for something else. And that, I think, is going to be uncontainable. It's going to be all these silly policies of trying to impose these puppet regimes, trying to bribe people, is not going to be able to contain the situation. You could have revolutions like in Iran. I don't know. People have always predicted. I can't say. What I'm saying is that something has to change, and if we don't let it happen, it's going to happen.
I'll just make a couple of brief comments. The question was, what role does the Arab regimes play? The obvious answer is, what we can say clearly from the record is, they're not an obstacle to resolving the conflict. Whether they can play a major role is hard to say. But what's clear is, they are not blocking a settlement. In fact, quite the contrary. The Arab League went beyond the international consensus and offered not just the termination of hostilities, but normalization of relations with Israel. Incidentally, even though it's not an Arab country, it's a relevant country, it's also true of Iran. When I was giving you the numbers, this past year, 164 countries supporting the international consensus. Go look at the record. That included Iran. It's among those countries supporting the international consensus for resolving the conflict. Now, some people say, well, how could you include Iran? You know, the president, look at him, that Ahmadinejad character. He's a Holocaust denier. And what sin can be more ghastly than being a Holocaust denier? That disqualifies him from consideration or membership in the civilized community. But the fact is, he's not the only head of state in the Arab world who's a Holocaust denier. In fact, there's one head of state in the Arab world who got his doctoral degree writing a dissertation denying the Nazi Holocaust. And this head of state was so pleased with his dissertation that he went to Lebanon to self-publish it. Now, some of you are wondering, which head of the Arab world is a doctor? And it happens to be Dr. Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority. Now, some of you are really perplexed now. How can it be that we demonize Mr. Ahmadinejad for being a Holocaust denier, but we celebrate Mahmoud Abbas as the quintessential moderate in the Arab world? And the problem with you, or most of you, is the reason you don't understand it is because you never saw The Wizard of Oz. How many of you have seen The Wizard of Oz? Okay. I see some of my former students in the room, so I'm about to render the theme song. Empress Farah did not like that, one of my former students. She never liked it when I sang in class. And if you remember in The Wizard of Oz, there were good witches and bad witches. The good witch was, I think her name was Glinda, if I'm not mistaken, and the bad witch I can never remember. And that's the same thing with Holocaust denial. There are bad Holocaust deniers, that's like President Ahmadinejad. And then there are good Holocaust deniers, and that's Mr. Mahmoud Abbas. And what makes you a good Holocaust denier is if you're a stooge of the Americans, then you're a good Holocaust denier. But they don't care about Holocaust denial. That's just a little tool, a little weapon to whip up hysteria against our alleged enemies in the Arab Muslim world.